Good morning. You're listening to KYRS. You're also listening to Praxis. I'm your host, Taylor, and today I'm going to be covering some exciting local-ish regional news that's been going on the direct action front. I was actually planning, as of last week, last Monday, at the end of my show to dedicate the following show to nonviolent direct action against the fossil fuel industry, because that's really popping off all over the country and the world right now. And just like that, on Monday night, this great action kicked off, led by the Nez Perce tribe and other partners just, you know, outside of Lewiston, so down the river from us a ways. And I was able yesterday evening to interview Helen Yost from Wild Idaho Rising Tide. And I have some feelers out with other folks from the tribe, from the Nez Perce, who are leading these actions. But unfortunately, that hasn't manifested yet. But I do have a great interview with Helen, and she does a good job summing up the whole story and how it came to the point that they were at on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday nights of this last week, the 5th through the 8th, with blockading Highway 12 and significantly slowing this so-called mega load from getting through. So that's what we're going to talk about today. And also just some implications of that, some history of other times in the U.S. when we've seen actions like this and then some, and what the future might hold as far as resource extraction in the U.S. I think it's really interesting. Towards the end of the interview, Helen mentions that the U.S. is on its way to becoming a fossil fuel resource colony for the rest of the world, which is very interesting. Having just heard that alternative radio segment with Dennis Kucinich talking about war and peace, and you know, it's no big secret that the U.S. wages its wars on the basis of securing natural resources to steal and extract from other places. So it looks like, you know, the tables may be turning in many ways. In some ways, the U.S. has saved their own natural resources for last. Obviously, you know, most of the old forests have been logged on this continent. Much of the coal resources have been extracted, but not to the extent that other places around the world have. So looks like we're next in some ways. And there's a lot of people who are not interested in seeing that happen. So this is just from this morning, this article on EarthFix on OPB. And let's see, from the Northwest News Network, Nez Perce seek court-ordered roadblock with second megaload on horizon. So something you'll notice in this interview is that people have really taken all the angles, you know, trying to go through the courts to stop these loads, which are just, I mean, it's absurd, the destructive potential that they have in this scenic byway, taking the legal route and then eventually taking this illegal route of blockading the road. So I'm just going to read this article out of Northwest News Network. Nightly protests on Idaho's Highway 12 delayed but did not stop a huge piece of oil equipment crossing the state. The so-called mega load passed through a scenic river corridor and entered Montana on Friday. Now the Nez Perce tribe is asking a federal judge to prevent more extra large shipments. The tribe and Idaho Rivers United are suing the U.S. Forest Service for not stopping the enormous truckload. The narrow, twisty highway route passes through the tribe's reservation and a federally protected corridor that contains many tribal, religious, and cultural sites. Earlier this year, a federal judge said the Forest Service has the authority to review permits for megaloads, and the agency has said it has not approved the shipment. But this month, when an Oregon shipper decided to push through anyway, the federal agency said it didn't actually have the authority to stop it. For this first megaload, it's now a moot point. The two-story-high, 250-foot-long water evaporator has left Idaho and is headed for Alberta, Canada. At least 32 Nez Perce tribal members and other activists were arrested trying to block its late-night passage on Highway 12, but now another large load is in the pipeline. A spokeswoman for Hillsboro-based Omega Morgan says the company hopes to start moving a second load around the end of the month. Omega Morgan has hired former Bush administration Agriculture Undersecretary Mark Ray as a consultant on the project. The company decided to start moving the first load after the Idaho Transportation Department issued the company a permit. In stern letters to both the shipper and ITD, Forest Supervisor Rick Brazell said the Forest Service, quote, does not consent, approve, or otherwise authorize Omega Morgan to transport the megaload through federally protected areas. The Forest Service had said it needs to complete an assessment in consultation with the Nez Perce tribe to determine how the huge trucks affect the intrinsic values of the area. Megaload opponents worry continued oversized traffic on Highway 12, which follows a route once used by Lewis and Clark, will lead to alterations of the byway and make it a regular route for transporting huge equipment to the oil sands in Alberta. The remote scenic byway is an appealing path through the mountains because it's accessible by river barge and doesn't have overpasses. It's also regularly used by recreators on the Clearwater and Lakesha rivers and by the tribe. Many local leaders see megaload traffic as a windfall for the port of Lewiston and businesses along the route. Omega Morgan has told Idaho transportation officials it has as many as 10 megaload-sized shipments it hopes to transport to Alberta. And as Helen will share in this interview, that first blockade and court battle and everything associated cost Exxon an extra $4 billion. So with 10 other megaloads, I mean, that's adding up to you know, almost $50 billion, theoretically. Hopefully more as people get better and better at blocking these loads. So without further ado, I'm going to play this this interview from last night with Helen Yost. She is coordinating some of these campaigns and actions with Wild Idaho Rising Tide. There's a little bit of background. There's a dog barking in part of the background. I cut most of it out, but there's a little bit left. So don't be alarmed if you hear a dog in your car or home while you're listening to this. Enjoy. So this is Helen Yost.
So I'm Helen Yost of Wild Idaho Rising Tide. And we are a collective and part of an international network of groups and individuals that take direct action to confront the root causes of climate change. And also we support community solutions to the climate crisis. So we, in conjunction with lots of other groups in the region, have been working to stop tar sands equipment heading through the Northwest region, but primarily Idaho and Montana, since May 2010. And initially, people found out a few years after the fact, actually, some of our higher government officials courted ExxonMobil's subsidiary, Imperial Oil, and asked them to bring some of these shipments, a lot of them equipment made in the Pacific Rim countries like Korea and China, to the port of Lewiston, which is the furthest inland west coast port. It's about 450 miles up the Columbia and Snake Rivers, and then ship those humongous modules up east of Lewiston, across the mountains of Idaho and Montana, and then up into Alberta. The route they wanted to use was Highway 12, and that is actually, it's a wonderful area. It's the Wild Snake River Corridor, goes through the large wildlands complex, and that includes both wilderness and roadless areas in the lower 48 states. The road is designated a scenic byway. It's also historically significant as the route of the Lewis and Clark Expedition and also the Nez Perce Trail to the Buffalo Grounds over in Montana. And it's also one of only 31 all-American roads in the whole United States. So folks are very attached to this area. Some people say it should be one of Idaho's national parks. It's so beautiful, even though it's just a twisty, windy road for about 100 miles through national forests and just really breathtakingly beautiful wild country with canyon walls and brilliant green water, and a lot of folks kayak and float the river as well when it's high water in May and June. So when we first learned that our government officials had already been courting big oil and other extraction companies to come through our most wild, precious area, people got really offended pretty quickly. And what happened is that our allies, Fife and Goliath, took first the first company that wanted to bring two half cloakroom of Highway 12 with ConocoPhillips, and they wanted to transport them up to Billings, Montana, to refit an oil refinery there. And I guess I should just preface all of this with saying that companies chose this route, Highway 12, because it has no overpasses. And a lot of these loads are up to 3 stories or 30 feet high. They can measure as long as 250 feet long. And the real dimension of concern is that they weigh, many of them, up to 600,000 and 700,000 pounds. Now, most semis weigh only about 80 to maybe 105,000 pounds to be legal on Idaho roads. So, of course, these loads coming through our region really crushed our public infrastructure in a state that has very little funding for road maintenance. Our good allies of Fighting Goliath took ConocoPhillips to court, and it was just district court, and the judge actually ruled in their favor and said that, yes, these loads didn't have the right to go off Highway 12 because they would endanger public safety. They wouldn't be able to meet the state rule that you have to clear traffic if it gets stuck behind you once every 15 minutes. And that generally, it would just be an imposition upon people in terms of safety and convenience. The other people traveling the road. They actually won just the merits of that case.
And sorry, just to back up a tiny bit, you said that your local government officials were kind of courting these companies. What is, this might be kind of a baiting question, but what would be the benefit of them coming through if there's all these detractions you just listed?
Well, quite a few of the locals, it being a relatively remote rural area, and they come to being, you know, somewhat less good shape in certain areas in the country. They look at it strictly from an economic sense. They believe that it's going to bring money into the state, either to the Idaho Transportation Department or to local businesses along the route where, you know, these loads would have convoys of about, a dozen or more cars. And so they, the hauler for a company that may own the loads subcontracts out to, let's say, a flagging company, a pilot car company, and so those folks may be regional workers, and of course they gain some work out of that, as well as, you know, the crew has to stay at hotels and eat at restaurants and such along the way. If the loads get stalled during adverse weather, as we saw several times during the first year that some of these loads were coming through, then, of course, you know, those crews are stalled in small towns that are hungry for the income even longer. And ironically, however, the state believed it would make money off of it, and we found after the first year, some of these loads coming through, again, it wasn't very many at the beginning, that the state had actually lost almost $750,000 in administrative costs, you know, doing the various analyses, bridge studies, for instance, and just all the time it took to analyze and permit these loads coming through. So the state actually did not end up going in the red with these companies, and they, of course, then, through the legislature, raised the amount that companies need to pay when they're permitted. There's still a pretty low rate, I'm guessing around $1,000 or $2 to move it across the state, just one module, one of these heavy modules. And we saw a lot of damage on the road on Highway 95, where ultimately some of these loads went, after they were cut in height, the company ExxonMobil had certified that they could not cut these loads in half, that they had to be moved through at their 30-foot height. And then when they got stalled in court, it's a long story, I guess I should back up to where we were with the last court case. That case actually won, but it went to the Supreme Court. And the Idaho Supreme Court and the judge there ruled not on the merits of the case, but on the procedural circumstances, and said that all of these cases have to start out at the administrative level, and that there needed to be a contested case hearing where a lawyer or a judge is actually agreed upon between ITD and usually conservation groups taking these cases to court, and he's the one that decides, even though he's chosen by the Idaho Transportation Department. And so there were, after the Supreme Court case hearings, one against ConocoPhillips, loads, which were ultimately allowed to go, and then one against the 200 loads that ExxonMobil wanted to bring through. And they had certified that they couldn't cut these loads in half, and then they ultimately did because they were so stalled by these court cases that they were in a hurry to get them up to Canada to build up car camp facilities up in northern Alberta. So they ended up bringing up those loads, and it ended up being, they didn't bring all 200 originally from Fort Lewis, and they only brought 33. So by the time they chopped those down, it was about 60 or 70 loads they brought up Highway 95 through Moscow. And we saw a lot of road damage from these loads that weigh so much. For instance, washboard grooves in the middle of lanes, drives in the middle of lanes. So we assumed that, all that damage was brought about, as well as numerous accidents. There were times when a load actually hit a car that had been pulled over by one of the flaggers because he didn't realize it wasn't time to go yet and practically tore the roof off of the van. There was also an accident that was precipitated by all the flashing lights and cars being stopped in the fast lane. One of the loads ripped off a huge, foot and a half diameter limb off of the tree. Power line was snapped when one of the guy wires was snapped by the load and went over the main wire. 40,000 people lost service in the middle of the night in April. An ambulance and a private vehicle, each carrying heart attack victims to the hospital, were both stalled. And there were numerous other dangerous circumstances on the road as these loads went through. It's very confusing conditions with lots of vehicles and flashing lights, and it's often hard to tell where you're supposed to go and when you're supposed to go. And it's just been a dangerous operation all along. And so the whole ExxonMobil Imperial Oil shipment fiasco more or less proved that to the Idaho, to a lot of the residents living along Highway 95. Now, they're trying to bring these same kind of loads off Highway 12. Even after a case in a federal court ruled, Judge Windmill ruled on February 7th, that the Forest Service, who oversees about 100 miles of forest land that these loads have to go through, the judge said that the Forest Service and the Federal Highway Administration, who of course administers some of these special designations, such as Scenic Byway and All American Roads, that those agencies have the authority to review and regulate these mega loads coming up Highway 12, especially because it goes through the Wild and Scenic River Corridor, which the state only has an easement with the Forest Service to run that road through there. The Forest Service could not exercise its jurisdiction when four ConocoPhillips half-cooked drums and the one ExxonMobil test module, which actually they hacked trees all on one side to make that fit through and make it up to Lolo Pass in Montana. They didn't say boo when those five loads went through. And the judge said that they were wrong to not do so. And so now, all of a sudden, now we have, over the winter, there were, in the since before the ruling, there was another six loads that came through. Three of them were Omega Morgan hauled loads, which is the company that's hauling the most recent loads that the Nez Perce rose up against. And so people at this point are pretty frustrated that there have been four court cases in Idaho. There was one that was successful in Montana only because they have an Environmental Protection Act in Montana, and the judge ruled that the Montana Department of Transportation, but nonetheless, by the time that ruling came through, had gone through the region, 350 total, for Vancouver, Custer from Portland, and for Pasco in the Tri-Cities area of Washington, and of course from Port of Lewiston up Highway 95, and then getting on the main interstates, I-90 and I-15 over in the Ute and then up to Canada. So people are very frustrated. We've been fighting this battle for 3 years now, and we are super grateful that the Nez Perce people have risen up and bring to this battle not only the concerns for the Wild Scenic River Corridor and the wildlands that many of the conservation groups have been voicing and raising court cases over, but also, of course, our main complaint on Highway 95 and in Moscow, the loads came through over the course of 8 months from July 2011 to March 2012, was we knew these loads were going up to the Alberta Tar Sands to completely devastate ecosystems and native cultures and subsistence lifestyles. But now, of course, the Nez Perce tribe is bringing forth concerns that some blows are going through their traditional homeland. It's not their federally designated reservation, and they have treaty reserved rights to be able to access hunting and fishing grounds. You know, their salmon have been impacted in the area because there's four dams on the Snake River that keep those salmon from coming and going and puts a dent in their subsistence lifestyle as well. So there's many, many concerns about these lures coming through. And after 3 years of battling this, and I know Transportation Department is still commenting these lures and more or less snubbing its nose at federal authorities like the Forest Service and Federal Highway Administration. Many of us feel like they have no recourse but to demonstrate in the road and blockade it.
So this the blockade on Highway 12, sprung up Monday the 5th, is that correct?
It did, and it ran for 4 nights, and it was perhaps some of the most passionate protests that our region has ever seen.
And I've just read an article in which one of the Nez Perce leaders says, you know, it's not over. Many of the leaders were arrested. Do you foresee, you know, more and more waves of people continuing this blockade?
Yes, with some of the folks of the Nez Perce tribe that I've been talking with, they are still very passionate about this, and we are super grateful that they're taking the lead in this situation, as, you know, we voice concerns about everything else. But those are people that live there, that have lived there forever, and of course, you know, we are more than happy to back them up in any way that we can. You know, that the fact that there were 30 arrests in just 4 days, you know, the whole time that the loads came up through Moscow on Highway 95, there were only 12 over the course of 8 months. This goes to show that I really doubt they're going to relent on fighting back any way they can through the courts and in the streets. So again, we're just grateful for their uprising and that even the Tribal Executive Committee were the first people who, you know, led the charge by symbolically being arrested and blockading at the front of the line. There were 8 of the 9 executive committee members arrested on Monday night in a blockade that started about 12:30 when the load arrived at the Nez Perce boundary line. And then behind those leaders, in the course of the two and a half hours that the road was blockaded, and this is 4-lane, somewhat interstate-style highway, then another 11 people were also arrested that night for a total of about, I heard, 19 or 20. Then the second night, load was, and again, it didn't make it very far that night. It was supposed to make it to about milepost 39. It only made it, I'd say, for maybe milepost 10 or such. And the next night, when that load started up, people actually marched down the highway towards it, led by the Nez Perce people and, of course, all their regional supporters from conservation groups and just concerned citizens. And they met that load as it was pulling out of its parking area. And at that point, the folks, you know, blockaded it only briefly, but then they ended up walking in front of the load and or along the, you know, even if you're on the other side of the white line, you're more or less putting the load in a dangerous situation, since these loads are 16 feet wide, and a regular lane is about 12 feet wide, so the highway is only 24 feet wide, so if you're walking alongside it, you're very close, and it's a dangerous situation. Even some of the children very ingeniously grabbed some rocks and threw those into the road. These roads have to go through river canyons that are really steep, so there's always plenty of rocks laying around everywhere. And then that took, of course, the convoy personnel a while to pick those out of the road. And ultimately, the load made it through, and it was only supposed to go to Kamiai that night. I think it was milepost 70 or so, but it went all the way. I'm not getting ahead of myself. I'm not really sure where it parked that second night. The third night, there was also another blockade. And at this point, it was near Orofino that night, which is actually, I think that's about the milepost they were supposed to go to the first night, but they finally made it to the second night. And that's about milepost 39, as I was saying. So on the third night, there was also many people. At all these protests, there has been anywhere from 100 to 200 folks that turn out to blockade. And this time, the police, and this is, you know, consortium of police led by the Idaho State Police and also the county sheriff and also the tribal police, actually, believe it or not, were on the side of these convoys and of the state police and arrested some of their own people. They were the people that, even though the Idaho State Police made the arrest, that the tribal police were the ones that hauled off the tribal executive committee members the first night. So on the third night, folks again attempted to blockade. This time, the police approached them very rapidly with their vehicles, pretending like they're going to run them over to try to scare people off the road. And they very aggressively, got out of the cars and started yelling at people and started pushing them off to the side of the road and made it through relatively quickly on that third night. And then broke the convoy and the module actually broke its transportation plan agreement to pull over 15 minutes to let traffic pass and made people ride behind it at a pace of only about 15, maybe 20 miles an hour for hours that it took them to go 50 miles to their next parking spot. And we believe that was probably in agreement with the state police in that most of the 40 or 50 cars that were following that load and its convoy were probably the protesters that wanted to get ahead of the load and, of course, blockaded again before it got any further. Mm-hmm. So on that third night, it made it all the way up to milepost 90. Now, the National Forest and the Wild Scenic River Corridor starts at about, roughly about milepost 74, 75. And since it was in the intention, especially of the conservationists, can we perhaps get ahead of those loads and block it as it started to come on to their federal lands, which, again, recently a federal judge has stated that the Forest Service did have authority to not allow the loads on that land. But Forest Service didn't take any kind of action, and Megalode was already in that corridor. So at that point, the Nez Perce Tribe and a conservation, one conservation was currently led by Idaho Rivers United. They had already been working on filing some papers that requested an injunction, especially while the module was inside the Wild Scenic River Corridor and the National Forest Boundary. And they filed that on a late Thursday afternoon, and while the load was in that area, and then that night went out, the executive director of Idaho Rivers United actually served those court papers, not only, of course, to the legal authorities, but also from a truck driver, which didn't stop him at all, of course. But there were protesters that turned out also in numbers on that Thursday night, this last Thursday, and the load did make it through, although we heard that it had to be winched over Fish Creek Bridge, that bridge was so incapable of holding the weight of that load that they actually did not drive it over on a usual specialized trailer that sort of twists and turns and both the loads sort of in a girdle formation, but they had to separately winch the loads, without touching any part of the bridge over it, which goes to show that the bridge, they shouldn't be running these loads up a road that has bridges that don't have the capacity to handle the weight of these loads. So that night, the load made it all the way up to milepost 4 in Montana, just over the border in Montana, over Lolo Pass. And we hear from our Montana colleagues they are planning a protest. We don't know exactly where, but when that load starts up and probably heads through Missoula on Monday night. And a lot of folks all across the region, either in solidarity with our good indigenous allies standing up for their rights that are impacted by these loads coming through, or, again, for reasons of protecting wild, federally designated lands, but mostly because these evaporators, this is the first of, they say, up to 10, and we've heard that the other 8 are actually being shipped right now from where they're made in the Vancouver, B.C. area down the coast of Washington, to Port Vancouver, Washington, to be barged up the Columbia and Snake Rivers. These evaporators that look like sort of the top part of a rocket ship, of like a Saturn rocket from back in the 60s and 70s, they are going to be used to generate steam that is then injected underground and sort of like fracking with some dangerous chemicals and loosens up tar sand or bitumen and is extracted and takes tons of water and energy to separate out the dirt and the clay and the water from those should be up in arms everywhere. The Alberta Tri Sands, most of the product from that area comes to America and we consume it. So, it's about 90% or more that Americans consume. And so, in fact, it's our dirty little secret in the far north wilds of Alberta that we should all be taking personal responsibility for and not allowing these facilities to be built up anymore. A lot of people have become mobilized by opposition to the NextEL pipeline, but quite frankly, we look at the blows from the front door project to build up the facilities that either mine the subsoil injection process or process the surface mining processes over tar sands before they're even put in the Keystone XL pipeline. So we all across the country should be against any loads coming from anywhere to build up these facilities. Typically, they go through from Asia and touch through the Panama Canal and up through the Kingston area and the middle of the continent.
Obviously, the point partially of blockading and doing these protests and slowing the mega loads and, ideally stopping them is to make it no longer profitable for them to do this and take this route. For how long do you think they'll continue to try as these actions escalate in Idaho and Montana?
The company will try to bring loads,
yeah.
Or that people will try to blockade?
Well, both, hopefully.
Well, unfortunately, it seems that, these companies are very arrogant. And like many, dirty energy companies, oil, coal, natural gas, they typically have the blessings, if not the subsidies, of federal government as well as state government. So unless we can figure out ways to regulate them through those means, then oftentimes all you're stuck with is local actions, perhaps local jurisdictions putting forth resolutions against them, which really doesn't have a lot of legal standing. This corridor is quite frankly very prized by these companies that want to bring loads in to fall to sit under overpasses on interstate highway systems where you could argue they might be more appropriate. And it's a shame because it's not just perhaps this industrial corridor that they're trying to establish here in the northwest and northern Rockies region, but other areas that are relatively wild that don't have, obstacles in the road that could become vulnerable at some point to the massive carbon extraction that's going on in the United States and across the continent right now through various things. There's mountaintop removal, there's the Northwest Coal Export Proposal, there's liquefied natural gas ports proposed all over the country, and, for fracking in everybody's backyard. We're turning into North America, that is, a carbon resource colony for the rest of the world market, who's hungry for industrial growth. And we see this just as the beginning of a long battle, quite frankly. And, there are many, many battles against tar sands, not just the Keystone XL pipeline, all across this country. And we all, need to stand up to all these various ventures and demand alternative energy. What we are most fearful in terms of the Highway 12 corridor and possibly other roads in the Northwest turning into some kind of industrial supply route, not just the tar sands, but perhaps also, as Paul Lewson has quoted various companies, a supply route to the Bakken shale oil fields in North Dakota and southern Alberta, is that especially in the case of the Alberta tar sands, a large proportion of those facilities in northern Alberta are financed, if not more or less underwritten, by Chinese, not Chinese companies, but also the government itself. And so, of course, where are they going to want to have their equipment made? In China, where it's the cheapest, and they can ship them through the Northwest, and, of course, the potential of tar sands being shipped out by rail all along the rivers and the mountains, valleys. There's high potential for accidents having to do with water all across the Northwest. Bakken shale oil just started being shipped out in long trains of 125 cars just this last fall. So in various pipelines, such as the Northern Gateway out to the East Coast, or, for instance, the Keystone XL pipeline aren't built, then there's the possibility for tar sands and other kinds of oil being moved massively on rail across the Northwest. So this is just the beginning of a long, difficult fight on many fronts all across North America.
Great. Well, thank you so much. And is there anything else you want to add?
Yeah, I just would like to say that, systems have a lot of weight, maybe as consumers, but also as blockaders, in that, their success, even though it's not readily apparent, for instance, when ExxonMobil, its Canadian subsidiary, brought 350 modules to build a tar sands extraction plant up in northern Alberta. The region pretty much between the summer of 2011 and the summer of 2012, people caused them with so many delays, both in the courts and then for added security of some sources and, private companies guarding parking areas of these megaliths, that they cost ExxonMobil over $4 billion. Their original estimates were $8-something billion to build this one plant, and it turned out costing them $12.9 billion. So I would encourage people to oppose in any way that they can find. It's writing letters, if it's signing petitions, it's getting out in the red blockading, it's taking things to court. All of our efforts are valuable, and we all need to oppose dirty energy going onward because of climate change, but also because all of the native people and great wild places that will be ruined in the process, not to mention water and dwindling supplies in terms of it being fresh, and of course climate change looming on the horizon. So we are successful, and it's not always apparent, but we all need to keep working on this issue so we can make a transition to clean alternative energy.
So that was Helen Yost with Wild Idaho Rising Tide, and an interview that I recorded with her yesterday, Sunday, August 11th, 2013. And right now it's Monday morning. You're listening to Praxis on KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio. I'm expecting a call from one of the Nez Perce leaders engaged in this action at any minute. Hopefully it comes through. We arrange these things at the last moment, and usually they work out. So Helen there gave a really good overview of what's been going on with this megalode action from the early stages of opposition more traditionally. At the end there, she kind of listed the general, letter writing, petition signing, neither of which were very effective. The courts, which were also ineffective in this sense. There's a lot of confusion between different federal management, tribal management, local governments, state governments, the levels, it just really shows how the processes, the legal avenues can become so convoluted that even if you have a ruling in your favor, sometimes it doesn't matter because things are already moving forward and enforcement doesn't exactly happen the way it should. So then, we get to the point where there's a physical blockade, a physical attempt to stop what's going on. And Kevin Taylor, who's a local journalist writing for The Inlander and other outlets, this piece he wrote is published on Indian Country Today MediaNetwork.com. Long URL, but descriptive. And I'm going to read part of that. He interviewed Silas Whitman, who's the Nez Perce tribal chairman. And he was one of the tribal leaders that was arrested. 8 out of the 9 executive council were arrested. So I'll just start in the middle of this article. Again, this is from Kevin Taylor's piece in Indian Country Today, MediaNetwork.com. The cry went up just after midnight on Monday, August 5th, the beginning of a protest against megalodes through Nez Perce territory along Scenic Highway 12 in north-central Idaho. By Friday, August 9th, 30 tribal members and their leaders had been arrested. Foremost among them on August 5th was Tribal Chairman Silas Whitman, who joined 6 members of the tribe's executive council, grabbing wooden barriers and striding out onto U.S. Highway 12. A rush of more than 200 tribal members and others, from grandmothers to children, followed, all determined to stop a football field-sized megalode from passing through their sacred lands. A phalanx of Idaho State Police cruisers idling in the darkness nearby flipped on their headlights and rooftop light bars and rolled to within yards of the blockade. It was an eerie blue and red strobe lit standoff. Tribal members sang and drummed and whooped while Stony State and tribal police faced them, arms crossed. Looming behind the police came the megalode, its cylindrical face appearing as an enormous ghostly moon swathed in a white tarp. The 23-foot-high load was a water evaporation unit that weighed 644,000 pounds and hooked up on dollies with a diesel truck at the front and back was nearly as long as a football field at 243 feet. It ate up nearly two full lanes of road. The blockade lasted for 2 hours. Whitman and his council members were arrested on charges of disorderly conduct and then taken to the county jail along with a dozen other tribal protesters. Feeling ignored by state and federal officials and increasingly concerned that oil companies are working with Idaho to convert the federally designated wild and scenic portions of Highway 12 into an industrial high and wide corridor to the oil sands, the Nez Perce have been riled into direct action, Whitman and others said. The protest came as the Nez Perce prepared to mark the anniversary of the Battle of Big Hole from the 1877 Nez Perce War. By Friday, August 9th, at least 30 people had been arrested. The nightly protests and blockades and youngsters placing rocks in the highway had slowed but not stopped the megalode as it lurched across Idaho's narrow panhandle, escorted by increasing numbers of police. So some of that's redundant to the interview we just heard with Helen, but I like that he brings up, and I'm hoping if we can talk to someone from the tribe today, the history of this region, of that specific site, looking at Chief Joseph and the Nez Perce and the many battles that took place in 1877 and the years before and after, after failed treaty talks, the treaties that are now being violated by these megalodes going through. So it's kind of one frustration on top of another leading to action. Direct action. So there's other organizations working on this in solidarity with the Nez Perce. There's an organization called All Against the Hall, which you can find at allagainstthehall.org. They have some really good frequently asked questions, fact sheets, you know, how likely are accidents, how do megalodes threaten public safety, how do they threaten emergency response, what is the exact route the loads will travel, might be good information for folks to know. And there's others who will help you stay involved. Wild Idaho Rising Tide has an email list on which they send out action alerts, invitations to come and participate in these actions. And as Helen said, you know, and as Silas Whitman said, it's not looking to end anytime soon. So in a somewhat, I guess it's not a coincidence, I sought it out on purpose. Since I now have Netflix again, I've been going on some documentary binges, and I was finally able to watch If a Tree Falls, which is, it's If a Tree Falls, a story of the Earth Liberation Front. And it's a very interesting documentary. It follows one member, whose name I'm now looking for, one ex-member of the Earth Liberation Front, Daniel McGowan, and he was arrested in, I want to say, 2005 for arsons that ELF claimed responsibility for in a couple different states. And it was a very interesting documentary. It was about obviously kind of just the history of the ELF and how that emerged. And it's a similar story. It's a story of, you know, people being fed up with the ineffectual nature, often, of lobbying, of public protest. They saw, it was specifically, a lot of these seeds were planted in Eugene, Oregon, and around that area where there was a huge amount of old growth logging being opened up, clear cuts you would just stumble across in the forest. Other actions like that, not the kind of fuel extraction we're seeing now, which is, I mean, it's all damaging. I don't think it's I don't think it's really important to argue what's worse, you know, old growth logging or fossil fuel extraction. But obviously these very destructive activities done, you know, in defiance of public opinion and like scientific reason. We need trees to continue life on Earth. We need water also, and this fracking and tar sands extraction uses water at a huge rate and also pollutes water in a very impressively thorough way that we really don't need to see all around the country. So anyway, this documentary follows that that arc of activists becoming frustrated with these actions not working, and eventually, you know, a handful and then more independent cells around the country, you know, radicalizing, as they would say, and eventually moving toward arson, burning and tree sits, and specifically this blockade, which I'm trying to find the part of this. Sorry, there's a specific section of this article I'm looking at that talks about where that blockade was, but it doesn't matter right now. But whether, and I think the documentary also did a great job playing with this idea of, what it was really examining at the end was this notion of terrorism. What's terrorism? Because eventually, Daniel, this young man, was McGowan. He was charged as a terrorist, as an eco-terrorist. And the movie kind of closes with his trial and his hearing. And he's facing all, he and the conspirators were all offered plea bargains. They didn't want to testify about one another. Some did, some didn't. They had various jail sentences brought down upon them. He ended up pleading guilty to the arson and receiving 8 years in federal prison. But he also, the judge found that the terror enhancement was valid to charge him with, and charged him with the terror enhancement. So he's in a maximum security special terrorist keeping facility that was built after 2001 in the kind of spree of anti-terrorism, so-called crackdown. And I'll read part of this review. This is on the Daily Beast. It's by Marlo Stern. At this point, meaning around the turn of the millennium, ELF actions died down, and Pickering, along with McGowan and several others, moved on to greener pastures. Then came 2004's Operation Backfire, the Bush administration's post-9/11 crackdown targeting eco-terrorists. With the help of Ferguson, who federal agents flipped to their side, that's one of the young men who was involved in these arsons as well, who agreed to wear a wire, the FBI and ATF indicted 13 former ELF members on a total of 65 charges, ranging from arson to use of destructive devices. McGowan and his co-conspirators were branded terrorists, even though the ELF attacks were meant to cause economic damage and no humans were ever harmed by ELF actions. Quote, there are people who would say ELF are terrorists and people who shoot abortion doctors are not, and there are people who would say just the opposite, end quote, said Curry. The word terrorism has been stretched too far, but that said, talking to the arson victims, they thought their house might get burned down in the middle of the night. There is a definition of terrorism that can include things like that. Since McGowan refused to give information on his fellow cell members, he received the harshest sentence, 7 years at a communications management unit facility in Marion, Illinois, dubbed Guantanamo North. CMU facilities are secretive prisons, often housing terrorists, that severely restricts any and all contact with the outside world. He's since been moved to a CMU facility in Terre Haute, Indiana, and is due for release within the next few years. And today, aside from the occasional act of petty vandalism credited to the ELF, the movement has all but dissipated. It's unfortunate that it didn't build a revolutionary movement in this country, said Pickering. It seems like it was very close at one point, but now that repression has set in so heavy, we think signing petitions and giving tax-deductible donations are all that we can do. But movements rise up really strong, get beat back, and then rise back up again. On the horizon is a stronger, smarter movement that will learn lessons from the mistakes that were made in the past. So that sums up some of what's explored in this documentary and that notion of terrorism. I mean, to be charged with terrorism when no humans were actually injured, you know, is property destruction violence, is kind of the main question there, because all that was ever destroyed was property meant to cause economic damage, which, you know, as Helen said really overtly in this interview and others have said, the point of doing a blockade, aside from stopping the actual destructive activity that's going on, is to to cause economic damage, to cause losses that shift the plan for the people doing the extraction. So it's interesting. It'll be very interesting to see how these, you know, the various direct actionists working on the tar sands, working on the Keystone XL pipeline, whose numbers are growing all the time. If you haven't been following those actions all through the U.S. and Canada, many of them indigenous-led projects with a lot of people working on them. There's really interesting stories going on. I highly encourage people to just look up some of this anti-tar sands, anti-Keystone XL coal actions. And the thing to be wary of is the law enforcement response to this. I mean, to see tribal police working with state police, state patrol, you know, this kind of, I don't know, conglomerate of law enforcement to stop these blockaders from doing this, coupled with, you know, just the other day, the sheriff, Ozzy Knezovich in Spokane County, came out and supported the, you know, the right, basically, of these coal exports to travel through Spokane, obviously against public opinion. I'm hoping to see that that fight against the coal exports ramp up a little bit more as well. You know, there's been a couple demonstrations. There have been actions like that. But as far as shutting things down, like has been done with the mega loads, it hasn't got to that point yet. Obviously, logistically, that's harder with rail, more dangerous, and we'll see what happens. But it's all very interesting stuff to explore, and we'll see how the Obama administration compares to the Bush administration when it comes to, as these actions escalate, which I believe they probably will, as more and more people get involved, you know, the growth of these movements is exponential. As people see more direct effects in the Midwest, as more people's, you know, water is flammable, more people will get involved in anti-fracking work. Hey, it looks like we're getting that call right now, so I'm going to take it right at the end of the show here.
Hello?
Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Oh, this is Julian Matthews from Nesford Tribe, and my cousin wanted me to call someone, but I forgot about, and that's kind of late, I guess. But
hey, no worries. I've got about 6 minutes left, so do you just want to talk about who you are and what your actions with this Megaload campaign have been?
Okay, it all started, I think, when the ExxonMobil was first bringing China. What they planned to do was they got permits from the state of Idaho, the IDT, Idaho Department of Transportation. And they're trying to bring, eventually what they want to do is start with a couple of these megaloads. What they are is evaporators, which they use in processing the tar sands. They use, like, I don't know, some ungodly amount of water daily to process it, kind of separate it out from the, that's what they call tar sands, and they mix it with water, and they separate out the tar and make oil out of it. And then, so what they start doing, this is probably around 2011, I think. And so what we did, we had a couple meetings and had about 10, 15 people at the most at these two meetings within the tribe, and we had some other folks from Friends of the Clearwater, where I serve. I'm an advisory board member for them. They do a lot of issues, deal with a lot of issues down here on our treaty area, like with the Nez Perce and National Forest and the Clearwater National Forest, because that's where the tribe's 1855 treaty rights are, primarily a lot of it. And so we got them and had a couple of rallies and then had a meeting. And then Winona LaDuke, she happened to be in Wallawa at a fish camp, they call it. It's like a book where these people that write books get together. So she came up and talked to us and talked to the elders and supported us. And so then we had some rallies. And I think we stopped ExxonMobil for a while. But then with these recent ones with Omega Morgan bringing these GE evaporators through the state, basically to me is kind of telling the tribe and the Forest Service that they don't care what you think or what you do or what you think is important, is we're going to roll these through. Like the chairman, our chairman said it really good. He said, well, these big corporations or oil companies think they can roll over people wherever they are. And so then what we did was there were some rallies that were set up, or the first night they're going to roll, I believe last Monday night. So we had a pretty big rally in front of our Clearwater River Casino Express, and there's probably about 250 people there, tribal members, Nez Perces, other tribes, and non-Indians like from Moscow, Pullman, Lewis, and whatever, Reagans, that were there. And we had a blockade on the road, lasted about 3 hours to slow them up, and they they left, and they only made it down about maybe a mile and stopped there. So the next night we went down and did the same thing, blockaded them, stopped them in this little kind of tight area. And then, but then they kept going after that. And so essentially, and then the court is filing a case to force the Forest Service to stop them, because last year Rivers United and the tribe went in on a lawsuit and to sue the Forest Service, U.S. Forest Service, because that's where Highway 12 goes through after it gets south of Kuski on a reservation. That's where it goes through all the way up to pretty much Lolo Hot Springs. And so then that court case, they filed. What the court said is that the Forest Service does have authority to regulate permitting or passage of vehicles through the forest because it's a wild scenic area, it's a wilderness area. And the FHA, the same thing, they sued both of those agencies. And then the Forest Service with this, they wouldn't do anything. And, you know, the Rick Brazell, the Forest Service supervisor here, he said, well, I can't stop them, I can't do anything. And so the tribe put in Rivers United last Thursday, I believe, submitted a request for an injunction. And so that should be heard this week. And so,
yeah. And I just read that on here, and I'll be following that throughout the week. What, what's next? I mean, I read a quote from Silas Whitman, the tribal chairman, saying that, you know, this isn't over. How far, in your opinion, do you think tribal members and other solidarity activists are willing to go to keep these from traveling through your land?
Well, I think that, I mean, realistically, I mean, it was pretty peaceful the other night. And to me, I mean, it was peaceful. But the thing is I think, like, there's been other actions by tribes, like the Chauvin, where they're trying to bring this uranium radioactive waste to the Idaho National Engineering Laboratory, and they blocked the roads and the train tracks. The tribal police just parked their vehicles on the tracks and things like that. Because I think, to me, it's not, you know, it's just like, okay, realistically, the ITD has the authority, supposedly, to authorize these permits to transfer these on Highway 12 because it's a state highway, et cetera. But the thing is it's more of a, to me, it's more of a political thing. And I think if they continue to try to bring these through, we're just going to step up our efforts and get more people involved. And I think, realistically, to me, I mean, because it's not like the tribe, NEPTIC, the council is in charge of the people, you know, like they don't say, okay, people, let's quit it. We're done now. We tried our best, et cetera. A lot of the people, that's what was so interesting, was the people, like the NEPTIC, they were getting arrested by our tribal police, and they came out and said, well, you guys should mellow out, go home, we're arrested, you know, and then people just stayed there because they've kind of taken on a life of its own. And it's really hard to predict, you know, what people will do. That's the thing. It's just like any action. I mean, there's certain things you don't know what's going to happen, and that's the problem, I guess, realistically, too. And so, like, I'll tell you one thing. About 3 years ago, I had a big meeting up in Cami. I showed that H2 oil movie to a bunch of people. There's about 55 people there. Five of them were tribal members. The rest, 50 of them, were non-Indians that live in the area that oppose the megalos. And so I said, well, you know, it's like down in Boise, they're giving us all these directives and authorizing these permits. Let's have Butch Otter and Brian Ness, the ITD director, come up and talk to us about that. You know, we're citizens of Idaho. We live here. We pay taxes, et cetera. And I sent him a letter and no response at all. And it's just like ridiculous. Why doesn't Butch Otter want to come up here or Brian Ness? It's just like sad because they're sending out like the state police and the all these other people to deal with, and they don't, they won't come up here and talk to us. You know, that's ridiculous. They're elected officials, or ITD is appointed by the governor, but, you know, it's things like Butch Otter won't come up here. He never responded to my letter. That was non-Indians wanting it, not Indians. So it's not just an Indian, non-Indian thing, or Indian thing. It's a non-Indian thing, too. A lot of non-Indians that live here like this area. That's why they live here. They don't want to spoil by turning Highway 12 into a corridor for transporting evaporator equipment up to oil, tar sands, or any other oil-based site.
Great. Well,
but like I said, it's hard to predict. You can't predict what people are going to do.
That's the thing. I would assume that, you know, being consistently ignored by the governor and other elected officials, that tends to build public sentiment against them and what they're doing. And eventually that's noticed. So, you know, we'll see how it unfolds. Hey, is there anything else you want to add before we before we get off the air?
No, I will say that Senator Crapel, he came down and talked to the tribe about it last week. You know, so I figure, hey, Senator Crapel, he's an important guy, you know. He came down here
and
talked to
the
tribe.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's just that kind of mentality where they, I guess a lot of people and elected officials feel, you know, we're in charge, we'll tell you what to do, and the people have no say in it, and that's the main issue is we're, you know, it's still a democracy. It's just like a lot of us are veterans. I'm a veteran. I serve my country to protect those rights to free assembly, free speech, and to have our voices heard in a democracy. That's why we have the democracy. That's why we have the military. We want to make sure that everyone's voice is heard, and we don't feel, many people don't feel their voices are being heard by Butch Otter and the rest of them down there, down south in Boise. So
great. Well, hey, Julian Matthews with Nez Perce Tribe and Megalode Blockade, thank you so much for joining me, and I hope to see you down there in the future. I'll be covering
this on
an ongoing basis.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks. Great. So that was Last Minute Call from Julian Matthews talking about this this Megalode Blockade that's going, that looks to continue, you know, talking more broadly about anti-resource extraction, nonviolent direct action, talking about a history of nonviolent. Is it nonviolent? What is property destruction, violent or not? I got into a heated debate about that the other day with someone that I can't cover now, but you know, talking about some of this history, really recommend that people look into these actions, look into what's going on. Recommend the documentary, If a Tree Falls, the story of the Earth Liberation Front. It really shows how stories like this unfold and how what the effects are with the current policy that we have in this country, you know, as far as terrorism, what is terrorism? Etc. So, thank you so much for listening. You've been listening to Praxis on KYRS Medical Lake Spokane 88.1 and 92.3 FM.